For 91.3 FM, WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California. New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 306, recorded on May 3rd, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
This is episode 2 of our mini-series on the early U.S. oil industry, which we're doing on Arsenal for Democracy. As always, you can find the links and notes for each episode, including things that we weren't able to fit in the airtime, in a PDF with the episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com. Last week, we were talking about the Pennsylvania oil rush at the very beginning, and we were obviously tying it to some of the current stuff that's going on in the world with the volatility of the and low prices in the oil industry. But we are continuing this series, and we're going to want you to stick with us on this. It's obviously pretty important that you hear that first episode before you hear what we're going to be talking about today, or else it's not going to really make sense what we're talking about today. And then to give you an indication of where we're going from here, the next episode we are expecting to be talking about the U.S. railroads in this same time period of the 1870s. Last week we were talking about 1859 to the end of the 1860s. Today we're going to be talking about the 1870s. Next week we're going to focus on the railroads more specifically. It will become clear why we are taking this angle on all of this. The point that we are making, we are not just doing a history recap here. We are going to be making a point about some things that are happening currently in the U.S. economy or the global economy, especially with relation to the tech industry. But we need to go back to the beginning to the guy who basically, you know, invented these giant monopoly supply chain integration companies, etc., John Rockefeller and Standard Oil. So with that in mind, this is part two of the early U.S. oil industry, specifically the rise of Standard Oil. Before reaching the retail market, the early U.S. oil industry had three key elements in its supply chains: producers at the wellheads, refineries converting crude to refined oil, and the transportation sector, which, as we discussed last week, included rail, pipelines, rafts, and wagons, moving both crude and refined oil from place to place. Pipelines were relatively short distances in this time period, though. They were not long-distance transportation. Last week, we talked about the discovery of oil in northwestern Pennsylvania, the early efforts to transport it, and the extreme volatility in the market as new production came online faster than could be refined or consumed. Last episode, we discussed how difficult it was to move the crude oil out of the Pennsylvania oil regions to other places, destinations, but it was also critical to move refined oil from the refineries all over the broader Ohio, western Pennsylvania region to the major American cities and the foreign export docks. And this was done by rail on three railroads: the Erie, the Central, which is the New York Central, and the Pennsylvania. There were also long-distance crude shipping to refineries in Philadelphia and New York, or to foreign export crude terminals. This week, we won't be going into a great deal of depth on the railroads as an industry. That's coming up in our continued mini-series on the early U.S. oil industry, and it deserves its own episode, and we do have a lot to cover today, specifically about the rise of Standard Oil. However, the railroad industry is the backdrop for all of the schemes and conspiracies that we're going to be talking about today. The important part that you need to know for this week is that at the time that these conspiracies were happening in the 1870s, U.S. railroads were legally considered to be quote-unquote common carriers. That meant that under common law, they had to charge the same rates to every customer regardless of volume or established relationships. Things like the Interstate Commerce Commission and federal regulation of interstate rail traffic and shipping did not exist until quite a bit later. It didn't even start until 1887 and wasn't serious until quite a bit after that. The railroads established a system of rebates on the published rates. Again, the published rates had to be equal for all the customers, regardless of size or whether they had a pre-existing relationship and so forth. But the railroads created an elaborate system of rebates on those published rates to give their preferred customers or high volume customers discounts. And John D. Rockefeller's big innovation was to try to unify that rebate system and to use that rebate system as a sledgehammer to achieve various other objectives. So, Rachel is going to be talking first about Rockefeller's initial scheme, which was unsuccessful in terms of manipulating and exploiting these refined oil shipping rebates. And again, next week we'll be talking from the railroad perspective more about why they were offering these rebates. Rachel's going to talk about the South Improvement Company, a very short-lived failed effort to start kind of operating as a cartel, and then what the actual outcomes of it were that worked in Rockefeller's favor despite the overall failure of the scheme. And then I'm going to be picking it back up and talking a little bit more about what he did next after that. So Rachel, talk to me now about the South Improvement Company in the state of Pennsylvania and the surrounding states, and what Rockefeller was attempting to do with it initially and what he actually achieved with it.
Okay, so Rockefeller, in the late 1860s, he kind of saw the expansion of the oil industry, and he got on board pretty early in the Cleveland area. He quickly established himself as kind of a big name in oil refining in Cleveland, and his competitors kind of noticed that he was expanding at a rate that they were unable to. He wasn't buying his crude at a vastly different rate or selling his refined oil at a vastly different rate. So, they kind of got suspicious that he was somehow getting reduced transportation costs. So the Erie Railroad was giving rebates to companies based on the volume that they were shipping. And Standard Oil, as one of the largest companies, was able to negotiate rebates on those shipping costs that no other company could. So the way the scheme worked, at the end of the month, oil companies would send vouchers for their oil shipped for 40 cents per barrel, and they would get 15 cents per barrel back. This only applied to crude oil shipped from wells to the refineries. It didn't apply to the refined oil getting shipped back east. So the reason these rebates were a big thing was because the railroads were interested in maintaining these refineries in Cleveland because they were getting guaranteed shipping at really high rates.
If the refineries in places like Cleveland or places like Pittsburgh were to be outcompeted by some other refinery region, that would remove some of the traffic and business that the railroads had come to count on coming from those areas, shipping the refined product back east and so forth.
Right. So in particular, Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railroad and New York Central Railroads were interested in maintaining these refineries in Cleveland. They were in competition with railroads that were operating in the oil region in that northwest Pennsylvania region that we were talking about last week. Also, Pennsylvania Transportation Company and Empire Transportation Company, who were nominally rivals in the oil pipeline business, were investing in a refinery in Jersey City so they could kind of cut out the east or the western refineries completely and could kind of control the transportation of oil in that eastern area. So these Midwest railroads were very, very generous with granting these rebates. Ida Tarbell called it reckless, and the refiners weren't shy about asking for them. So Standard Oil kind of also saw that the Cleveland area was oversaturated with refiners. I think Ida Tarbell said, for every barrel of crude that got pulled out of the ground, there was a refining capacity for refining 3 barrels. So the area was just oversaturated with refiners, which pushed the cost of refined oil down. So Rockefeller wanted to control refining in the region so he could control the price of refined oil in the area. So he kind of began a scheme to buy small refineries by basically buying them out or forcing them out of business. And the way he did this was he started a company called the South Improvement Company. And the way he did this is he bought a charter, a business charter, at an estate sale. And basically he did this so he could fly under the radar. He just bought a really generic business charter.
Really generic.
Very secretively. And basically this charter gave him carte blanche to do whatever he wanted. The South Improvement Company can own, contract, or operate any work, business, or traffic, save only banking, may hold and transfer any kind of property, real or personal, hold and operate on any leased property, oil territory, for instance, make any kind of contract, deal in stock, securities, and funds, loan as credit, guarantee anyone's paper, manipulate any industry, may seize upon the lands of other parties for railroading or any other purpose, may absorb the improvements, property, or franchises of any other company ad infinitum, may fix the fares, tolls, or freights to be charged on lines of transit operated by it or on any business it gives to any other company or line without limit. Its capital stock can be expanded or watered at liberty. It can change its name and location at pleasure, can go anywhere and do almost anything. It is not a Pennsylvania corporation only. It can, so far as these enactments are valid or are confirmed by other legislatures, operate in any state or territory. So basically, they can do whatever they want in their charter. And they bought the name South Improvement Company because it also hid what they were up to, basically. So as it said, all their operations were secret. They kind of started putting out feelers to other refining companies under basically a non-disclosure agreement. They forced people that they approached to sign non-disclosure agreements saying that they would not tell anyone about what the South Improvement Company was up to. By doing this, they were able to buy up a whole bunch of refiners in the area. And the ones that they didn't buy up, they basically forced out and forced to sell their land or their property at about 45% of its value. So they quickly consolidated a lot of power.
And again, and the rebates were the sledgehammer, as I said, to get this, like to force out the competition.
Yeah. They said, we are able to get these shipping rates, you aren't, so basically we can force you out at any time. And they did. Another facet of the scheme is Standard Oil wanted to force Europe to buy refined oil. So he basically was forcing railroads to stop transporting crude oil destined for export to Europe. This angered quite a few people. The oil producers at the time kind of saw what was happening. They were a mix of minor producers and major producers backed by capital from the East, but the major producers were less prevalent than the minor producers. And the oil fields and the oil region itself was also home to many refineries, although a majority of U.S. refineries were located in these bigger cities that were farther away. But the producers saw what was happening, and this made them really angry. They didn't want their hand forced by Rockefeller and Standard Oil. So on February 27th, 1872, a whole big group of petroleum producers formed a union called the Petroleum Producers Union. It was formed in Titusville, Pennsylvania. They agreed to stop drilling for new wells for 30 days and to close on Sundays. And they also created a blacklist of known movers and shakers in the South Improvement Company. They also pledged to support independent creek refiners and to start to build and control their own rail lines so they weren't at the mercy of the railroads and Standard Oil. So, and also there was a newspaper in the area called the Oil City Derrick newspaper. They were key in spreading information about what the South Improvement Company was doing, and they also helped drum up public sympathy for the producers. One of the things that the South Improvement Company was working on was they contracted with the railroads to raise transportation costs by 100%, so doubling the rates of shipping oil. But the way they wrote the contract, the extra money actually went to the South Improvement Company, and they also got a reduced rate of shipping, and they got a $1 per barrel scrape off of all the oil shipped by their competitors as well. So they were able to basically control the railroads and get a lot of money from shipping the oil.
That was at least the plan anyway. This didn't really work out. It, you know, within a matter of weeks fell apart, and to the point of even triggering congressional investigations quite early into this, which is a bit surprising. But the key thing here is that you can see the outlines of what he was going to attempt to do. And initially, like, the railroads backed out pretty quickly from this deal. He had misrepresented to them how much of the refining industry he had managed to, like, bring into this South Improvement Company. He tried to say, oh, you know, we've got pretty much everybody on board and anybody else has been invited but declined. And that just simply was not true. So they did back out of it under this pressure from the producers' union in the oil field regions pretty quickly. But as Rachel has already already described, the part that succeeded was that he did manage to at least cripple and destroy or absorb almost all of the competition in Cleveland. And the reality is that once he had obtained control over the refining industry in Cleveland and pushed out almost everybody else, that was enough of a consolidation to then put him on the path to continue consolidating everywhere else, which is what we're going to talk about now. So even though the initial scheme with the South Improvement Company fell apart pretty quickly, and there were all these blacklists and so forth by the producers' unions, you know, the producers created their own cartel that instead of, you know, the refiners limiting the production and stuff of refined oil, they were going to limit the production of crude oil because they had, you know, stockpiled huge amounts of surplus oil, hoping that the price would go back up, and it was just getting to be a huge mess. They were also, you know, as Rachel said, they had all these grand ideas. Oh, we're going to start our own railroad and have worker co-ops and things like that, basically, you know, because a bunch of these guys were small business owners at the time. They weren't, you know, giant oil companies. So they were like, oh, we're the scrappy little guys. They were even like saying, oh, we're going to lobby foreign governments to get tariffs imposed on refined oil imports, but not crude oil imports, because then we can export crude oil to foreign countries directly instead of refined oil. And that was obviously directly in contradiction with Rockefeller's thing. However, this just did not really pan out. And Rockefeller, because he had managed to succeed in consolidating the situation in Cleveland, now began to really throw his weight around anyway against them. So again, this scheme that he had in 1871 falls apart on the implementation side pretty quickly by the beginning of 1872. But by November of 1872, he's already back in. He's proposing that Standard Oil will pay above market fixed prices, $4.75 a barrel, compared to the market rate in August 1872 of $3.47.5 per barrel, or $2 a barrel in January of 1873. And he would buy this, you know, crude oil from the producers' cartel. The producers who hated him would suddenly be forced to sell to his refinery cartel that he was promising, because they couldn't really pass up the extra money, and they really needed to get rid of this glut of surplus oil that they had in the tanks, because they were running out of tank capacity, which is, again, something familiar we've just seen in the last several weeks and months in the modern era. This, however, would cement his preeminent position. He also told them explicitly that if they didn't agree to this deal, that he would buy oil from the non-cartel producers who were violating attempted production shutdowns and things like that. So basically, he could give them a great deal above market rate, or he could pay much below by going to wildcat producers and unaffiliated producers and so forth and buying much cheaper for them. Now, again, you might say to yourself, well, why would he be paying this huge above market rate? Again, think of it in terms of the situation today that we see various tech companies giving various temporary pricings on things, because it's going to help achieve certain objectives within the market, or at least that's the theory of it. And again, he's the guy who kind of pioneers a lot of this stuff. The producers understandably were afraid that once Rockefeller had pushed out or acquired all his competition in the refinery business, he would drop back down to market price purchases of crude oil, but there was not a whole lot of choice. Despite objections from the leadership of the producer cartel, an agreement was signed for exclusive purchase from the cartel by Standard Oil under the guise of a quote-unquote refiners association of 15,000 barrels per day at generous above market rates, with a signing bonus of a huge upfront acquisition of 200,000 barrels of surplus oil to help clear out their stockpiles, although at a lower price than what he was offering for his daily rate. The agreement also disallowed any use of railroad rebates by Standard Oil. This was a key thing that they had insisted from the railroads earlier in the year. However, he was already secretly violating this provision already, and the railroads obviously were giving all kinds of rebates off the books as well, or secretly anyway. He terminated the agreement almost immediately, though, citing insufficient restriction of production, lowering the price too far below what he was willing to pay above market. Basically, he said they didn't keep up their end of the bargain because they couldn't control production. He didn't really have to complete the purchase of the signing bonus acquisition either, because the cartel was too slow to transfer it to him, because they were infighting with each other over whose stockpiles would be tapped first. This action completely shattered the producer cartel, as well as the attempted stoppage of pumping. Production suddenly ramped up massively on the basis that at least the producers thought, well, if I can't make a huge profit on a per unit basis, I can still make some profit on the basis of volume. So I'm just going to produce as much as possible. Again, you can consider some modern parallels to what we're seeing right now. By June of 1873, 6 months later, Rockefeller's refinery cartel dissolved itself. He was unable to keep association refineries in line with his production caps and price floors. The refined oil sector was also coming under pressure on the global market from new oil production coming online in foreign countries. So you could say, oh, well, second attempt, also a failure, except no, he continued his own refinery business, Standard Oil, with vast profits, and he kept his partners in the rail industry happy with the high volumes of shipped oil because, again, he had consolidated in Cleveland. This basis is the launch pad for everything that comes next. He cuts back on shareholder dividends, begins pouring money into supply chain acquisitions, buying up barrel factories, refining ingredient productions, direct ownership of tank cars so that he doesn't have to just use the tank cars that are provided by the railroad, which means he's in a much stronger position than all of his rivals who have to compete with each other to get access to tank cars. And he also bought terminal facilities in New York. He also made extensive capital improvements to his refining facilities. Now, in the next chapter of the Ida Tarbell book, we move into the next phase of this. Why did the railroads give Standard Oil specifically huge rebates? Obviously, they were giving almost everyone rebates at some point, but Rockefeller was promising the railroads huge guaranteed volumes of refined oil every day because of the size of his operations in Cleveland, which he had obtained through his first quote-unquote failed scheme. The railroads liked the stability of one large customer, as well as the advantages of being able to run a non-mixed train of just oil. For example, you could run a 60-tank car train of just oil from Cleveland to New York City. A round trip of a mixed train might take 30 days to send out and back because of all the, you know, having to switch things in and out at various yards and destinations and so forth. Whereas a Standard Oil train, just nothing but oil, could be shipped from point to point and back empty in 10 days. It was also cheaper because Standard Oil's standardization of their equipment and requirements. This was an obsession that Rockefeller had. The reason he called it Standard Oil was that he was going to set the gold standard for how the entire industry was operated. They were also compelled to offer him rebates once their competitor railroads had done so because he had multiple options for shipping his refined oil from Cleveland to the Eastern Seaboard. And so once he had started getting a deal from one, they had to get a deal from the other one in order to remain competitive with each other. Again, we're going to talk more about the railroad's perspective on this in an upcoming episode as part of this series. The Erie Railroad specifically was also desperate to build up its share of refined oil shipping business at the expense of regional competing railroads, and its corporate leaders had close personal existing relationship to the leadership of Standard Oil. Some of them had been part of the South Improvement Company before going to work at the railroad. They were able to negotiate not only a set of competitive price rebates to obtain 50% of Standard's shipments, but they also met a series of detailed demands by Standard Oil to ship directly from the Standard refineries in Cleveland to Erie-owned oil terminals in New Jersey, which Standard then leased and operated, thereby monitoring and servicing all of Standard's competitors among the refinery customers on the Erie Railroad. So even though his first scheme of getting the kickbacks on his competitors' oil failed, his third scheme basically resulted in him having direct control over the offloading and so forth at the other end of all his competitors' business anyway. And the basis of this was, well, I already have all these employees in my own directly Standard-owned terminals in New York, so, you know, I'm the one who knows how to do this business. It's not really the business of the railroads to handle this. And they said, sure, we will do this agreement with you. Standard Oil's huge business with the Erie and the New York Central could have risked a rate war between those two and the Pennsylvania Railroad, which carried most refined oil that wasn't shipped from Standard refineries at this point, in part because of its access to the Pittsburgh refineries instead of the Cleveland refineries. However, in 1874, their ally, the Empire Transportation Company, which Rachel has just talked about briefly, but we also mentioned at some greater length last episode, as a short-distance crude oil pipeline and long-distance crude oil rail shipping middleman, Empire began negotiating a complex agreement between the three railroads to divide up the entire region's oil shipments between them, with specific input provided from Rockefeller. Empire, working in collusion with its competitors in the pipeline industry, was particularly interested in finding a rail pricing accord set up that would incentivize crude oil shipments out of the oil region in northwestern Pennsylvania. Their whole business was to move it out of there, rather than encouraging a nascent localized refining industry from taking root. basically, if you were refining it in the area itself, then that took away Empire's business of getting it to a refinery somewhere else. This was achieved by agreeing to price, the railroads agreeing to price crude and refined oil shipments by rail and pipeline in terms of quantities and not in terms of distance, and to make crude shipments cheaper than refined shipments for equal volumes, and also to offer a drawback rebate that canceled the payment to ship unrefined oil to Midwest refineries in exchange for shipping the refined product longer distances to final destination points. The railroads had some reasons to do both of these things too, because first of all, crude oil needs to be transported by rail from the production region to refinery hubs in Cleveland, Pittsburgh, New York City, or Philadelphia, so that gives them some additional business. But more importantly, they were willing to offer a system of drawback discounts to make it essentially free to ship the crude oil to Cleveland or Pittsburgh for refining, because that avoided them losing all of their shipping traffic to seaboard refineries, right? If they charged too much money for shipping crude oil to Pittsburgh and Cleveland and then shipping the refined oil back across to the East Coast, they would lose a bunch of their important business in this specific part of the country, and they didn't want to do that. The railroads were also able to justify a pricing formula that effectively disadvantaged localized refinery in the oil fields by claiming that they were merely being fair by charging equal rates to ship refined oil regardless of location of the refineries. So they were claiming, oh, this is completely compliant with the common carrier rules. The refining hub cities had some inherent advantages over northwestern Pennsylvania in that they were already established manufacturing cities, and it was cheaper to bring in refining inputs, ingredients, and equipment. And the railroads ignored requests from the refiners in the oil field regions to level the playing field by providing rebates to ship those inputs into that region. So they basically boxed out the competition to these four hub cities outside of the oil fields. Now you might say again, well, what is the interest that Rockefeller and Standard Oil have in going along with this agreement, right? Because he's only the preeminent power in Cleveland. So why does he want to set up a system where you can basically freely ship to Pittsburgh or whatever, or you can have some of the crude oil getting shipped to refineries on the East Coast, not for free though, obviously, because it didn't benefit the railroad to ship that for free. They needed to have at least part of the leg of the journey not be free. And the answer to this, and why he helped Empire negotiate this, was that the new arrangement, even though it might result in more crude oil being shipped directly to refineries in the Atlantic port cities or Pittsburgh, was because he was in the process of persuading several friendly refinery owners not in Cleveland who had been involved in the abortive South Improvement Company scheme to transfer their refining operations in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia secretly to Standard Oil and to become shareholders while continuing to operate under their own names locally until such time as they had in turn bought out, leased, or bullied out all the competition in those cities as Rockefeller had done several years before in Cleveland. Simultaneously, Standard Oil secretly purchased a major refining company in New York City. By this means, Standard Oil secretly became the dominant refiner in the four major refining hub cities, including Cleveland, at the same time as the railroads were agreeing to create a de facto preference for shipping crude oil to any of the western hubs instead of refining oil more expensively but with shorter trips in the oil field regions, which could have become a fifth hub if it had been allowed to grow more naturally. As always, Standard Oil sought to become the standard maker in the oil refining industry, and it imposed strict controls on all refineries now under its aegis in these multiple locations. So now they had a whole pricing scheme that was set up very favorably toward all of his businesses, whether it was refineries in the West or refineries in the East. It was all perfectly priced so that there was no particular disadvantage, and he controlled the refining industries in these four locations. Now, as usual, it was pretty hard to keep this conspiracy a secret. As the new refiner monopoly came to light, or at least the hint of it, behind a new front organization posing as basically a trade group, like an industry advocacy group or negotiating cartel, they defended themselves by arguing that they were bringing stability to the market and an end to non-productive financial speculation. They adopted the mantle of being a movement for a better industry. I like that as a modern parallel. And production quotas were defended as trying to match supply more naturally toward demand to ensure, quote, reasonable profits. Increased prices in refined oil per gallon were also defended as both being capped at a, quote, reasonable price by what foreign markets would bear, as well as being necessary to cover all the production, refining, and shipping costs at the various points of the supply chain without bankrupting everyone. Rockefeller, now in nearly full control of the refining industry, now negotiated new rates with the three big railroads serving the four major cities whose refining capacity he now dominated. He asked for relatively small rebates, and they agreed initially. Then the three railroads met with each other to review how their own cartel negotiated by the Empire Transportation Company was working and to make adjustments. And at that point, they suddenly discovered that Rockefeller had been cheating them in their secret contracts with him because they didn't know that he had secretly acquired all these other refineries, and therefore they couldn't accurately assess the scope of his shipments to see whether they were getting the guaranteed percentages of his volumes that he had agreed to. Standard Oil's secret subsidiaries operating independently were furiously hard at work buying up any competitor in their hub city who would sell, or sometimes leasing if a deal could be struck easily, and bullying anyone who wouldn't sell by artificially underselling, creating backups and access to shipping cars, discouraging crude brokers from selling to refiners, and any other tactic. In Pittsburgh specifically, the railroad companies and pipeline companies openly refused to help any independent refiners try to cut their transportation costs from the oil fields that might have helped them remain competitive against standard refiners. From 1875 to 1878, Standard Oil's secret but suspected subsidiary in the oil field region itself, under the name Acme Oil Company, bought all but two local refineries under the crushing strength of the advantages of the rest of Standard Oil's empire outside of the oil fields. Everyone who sold out had to sign a non-compete clause barring them from opening a new refinery business for 10 years. Rockefeller also began acquiring or pushing out any independent and non-co-opted middlemen, bulk crude shipper companies, or individuals from the oil fields to independent refineries so that there would be even less leeway to cut costs and remain competitive against Standard. Also, he just didn't like middlemen. Rockefeller continued during this period to acquire more and more parts of the oil industry supply chain, even forcing acquisitions of companies that he had previously supplied refined oil too, because he was no longer content to sell product to them if he could simply operate the business that the customer had been operating himself. So he's doing horizontal integration of the industry that he himself is in, as well as vertical integration of all the different components of the supply chain and the markets themselves. In 1876, there was an attempted lawsuit against the railroads for preferential treatment for Standard Oil. This was quickly dropped after the litigants signed a secret contract with Standard Oil to obtain the same shipping rates on their behalf, to invest money in a brand new refinery, which they would operate under their own name as long as they met all the requirements and quotas requested by Standard. There was a guaranteed profit-sharing arrangement as well with Rockefeller, just giving them basically huge payoffs per year to make the lawsuit go away. And the secret contract that they signed was such a secret that Rockefeller said they couldn't tell their wives about it. They had to use a secret post office box, and they were advised that they were going to make so much money from the deal that they might be tempted to go buy expensive displays of wealth, but were advised not to do so to avoid drawing attention to the source of their newfound wealth. And that brings us to the end of this initial phase of the rise of Standard Oil, and the third phase, the beginning of the success of Standard Oil after two failed or mixed success situations earlier. Again, in our upcoming episode, we're going to be talking about the railroads and understanding the rail price wars, but that's still ahead. Rachel, anything that I did not get to in any of this that you wanted to highlight?
Nope, you went on a whirlwind there.
That's it for this week. Rachel, thank you so much for being on again this week.
Thanks for having me.